2 Kings chapter 24. We are finishing up the book of 2 Kings tonight. Believe it or not, it's been a number of months. I didn't stop to count, but I know it has been, well, maybe you would describe it as countless studies. Certainly the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings together, forming the original Hebrew book of Kings, has taken us quite a while, but it's been well worth it. In our last study, which was 2 weeks ago, we saw that there had been a short revival in the nation of Judah. Remember that southern kingdom of Judah is all that's left for the time being. By the end of our study tonight, it won't be left either. They had a short revival under King Josiah. Josiah was a righteous man, brought about all kinds of reforms, caused the people to make a covenant with the Lord. The temple was restored. The Passover was celebrated. The high places were torn down. Unfortunately, when Josiah died, things went right back to the way they were before, as you might expect. The nation was normal. Their normalcy was a terrible normalcy of sinful idolatry and immorality. That's where they are back. When Josiah died, two of Josiah's sons, each successively served as kings. I shouldn't say they were served as kings, not served as kings. The first one was Jehoahaz, and after he was replaced, with Jehoiakim, who is the king, as we pick up here in chapter 24. They both were evil. They both did evil in the sight of the Lord. They both followed in the footsteps of their ancestral fathers, the kings who had come before them. And as we pick up here in chapter 24, we see that Egypt's Pharaoh, Pharaoh Necho, sounds like maybe a breakfast bar. You know, what do you have to? Oh, nothing. I won't have anything. I already had a Pharaoh Necho. Pharaoh Necho had oppressed the kingdom of Judah. He had demanded a huge amount, a fine, he called it, for their rebellion of gold and silver. Unfortunately, as we are about to see, that's only the beginning of the oppression upon this troubled nation. You might recall back in chapter 20. I know that was a number of weeks ago. But back in chapter 20, Hezekiah, who is also by and large a righteous king, when he got a get well card from the king of Babylon brought by some messengers and even a little get well gift, the Lord had healed him. So he was so happy about that. He had taken them on a tour of the kingdom, showed them everything in the palace, showed them everything in the temple, showed them all the riches of the land of Judah. Had pridefully boasted about it because they were from so far away. What would they do? Well, Isaiah knew. He prophesied by the Lord back in chapter 20, verse 17. Isaiah told Hezekiah, "Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left." Well, as you recall, Hezekiah submitted his heart to God, said, "It's the will of the Lord. The word you have spoken is right. It's good." And so now we've gone a number of generations back. What we're going to see in these final two chapters is that prophecy taking place. The king of Babylon rising up against Judah and ultimately carrying off everything there was. So chapter 24, verse 1. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. And the Lord sent against him bands of Chaldeans, bands of Aramaeans, bands of Moabites. See, Judah was on the tour circuit. All the bands came through. And bands of Ammonites. So he sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken through his servants, the prophets. Surely, at the command of the Lord, it came upon Judah to remove them from his sight because of the sin of Manasseh, according to all that he had done, and also for the innocent blood which he shed. For he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord would not forgive. The king of Babylon came up a first time. Nebuchadnezzar comes up against Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, was in submission, was a servant to Nebuchadnezzar, as he had been to Pharaoh Necho previously. But I think a guy can only take so much. You know, as the cartoon character said, "That's all I can stands. I can't stands no more." Who was that? That was a Popeye. There you go. You guys are sharper than I am tonight. After 3 years, he rebelled. That was it. That was all he could stand. He was not going to be oppressed by anyone else. He wasn't going to put up with it. But you see, the Lord had dictated. The Lord had commanded. The Lord had spoken through the prophets, prophesying, saying, "This is judgment which is coming upon this people." And so no matter what he did, nothing would be able to be done. When he threw off the yoke of oppression from Nebuchadnezzar, what happened? All those bands came through, the bands of Ammonites and Aramaeans and Chaldeans. They all came through, didn't they? You see, when you try to get out from under the plan of God, have you ever tried this? It doesn't work. When you try and get out from under the will of God, now, you can get out of God's will for your own life, but if God says, "I'm going to do this to you, I'm taking you to the woodshed," you can run around all you want, but he's still going to grab you and take you to the woodshed. If you think with me for a moment throughout history, you may recall a prophet from these days, a prophet by the name of Jonah. He wanted to get out from under the plan that God had for him. God said, "Go, I want you to preach repentance to the Ninevites." So he headed in the opposite direction, hopped a boat to Joppa. Well, one big storm and one big fish later, where was he? He was at Nineveh. You can try to escape the plan of God for your life, but you will end up where he wants you. That doesn't mean the journey's going to be easy. You're going to make it far more difficult. If God desires to bring punishment or prophecy, if he wants to bring encouragement or exhortation, trying to get out from under it, it just doesn't do any good. You might recall, too, the time when Magi from the east came to Jerusalem, and the Roman king Herod was ruling over the Jews at the time, and the Magi said, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?" Ooh, that's not what Herod, a very jealous man, very prideful man, very suspicious man, that's not what he wanted to hear. He tried to get out from under the plan of God. He knew that the Messiah, the King of the Jews, had been born. He tried to make sure that it wouldn't happen, that God's plan would not come to fruition. Do you recall what he did? He sent to Bethlehem and to all the surrounding areas that all the children be killed. According to the years ascertained by the Magi, he had them all killed. And yet, what happened? God was still in control. God's plan was still going to be accomplished. Joseph and Mary being warned, Joseph specifically being warned by an angel in a dream, took the baby Jesus and his wife Mary and fled to Egypt until Herod had died and his brother came to be ruler. And even though Jehoiakim desired to throw off the yoke of oppression from the Babylonians, what happened? Well, that empty spot. Have you ever taken a rock and thrown it into a pool of water? Oh, you get a nice empty space for about a half a second. But the rest of the water comes rushing in to fill that gap, doesn't it? Well, the same thing happened. When the yoke of oppression of the Babylonians was thrown off, what happened? God's will was accomplished through the Chaldeans and the Ammonites and the Aramaeans and the Moabites. He was sending them against Judah to destroy it, for the end of his mercy had come, and now he was exercising justice. Well, now the rest of the acts, verse 5, the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Yes, they are. We are not going to go into 1 and 2 Chronicles after this, for much of it would be a repeat. We will do that probably a couple years from now in review. But you can read 1 and 2 Chronicles and read about these kings. You can read 2 Chronicles and read more about Jehoiakim. So Jehoiakim, he died. He slept with his fathers. And Jehoiakim, his son, original name, his son became king in his place. King Jehoiakim. I wouldn't want to have to call him that. And the king of Egypt did not come out of his land again, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt from the brook of Egypt to the river Euphrates. Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father had done. Well, what the author of Kings is telling us here is that when this new king, Jehoiakim, the son of Jehoiakim, when he became king, Pharaoh Necho wasn't a breakfast bar. He also wasn't a factor. He wasn't a problem. Why not? He had been oppressed as well. The king of Babylon had taken all that northern territory of Egypt that Egypt had conquered. And so it's telling us that Egypt is no longer a factor in the problems of Judah, only Babylon, because Babylon had conquered them. And Nebuchadnezzar is becoming even more powerful. And at that time, verse 10, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother and his servants and his captains and his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign. Nebuchadnezzar took all the northern territories of Egypt, and now he's directed his attention to Judah, specifically Jerusalem. For if you could wipe out a capital city, the center of power in a nation, the rest of it would fall fairly easily. They besieged the city. If you recall what a city under siege consisted of, it was a very effective plan of attack. You may recall that cities back then were surrounded by walls so that armies could not attack very effectively. They would have a very hard time as they would try to throw ladders up there. The ladders would be pushed off as they tried to attack it. The boiling oil would be poured over, or the catapults or the arrows and whatever else they had up on the walls made it very difficult to attack. If you could get in there long enough, you could dig under the wall and undermine it. But how could you do that when all these people up on the walls were firing down at you? So a walled city was a very difficult thing to attack. They worked around it. What they did was they would besiege the city. When a city was under siege, they would merely surround it at a safe distance, but they would surround it with enough men to form an entire circle, an entire camp around the city, thus cutting off the supply lines in and out. The farmers could not grow any crops because, you know, in a walled city, you're not growing crops inside. You're going out to the fields outside the city. Well, the farmers can't get in or out. The supply lines, the traveling people with their caravans of camels and supplies could not get in, could not get out. Very often a city's water supply was from a source outside the wall. So it would sometimes only take weeks, sometimes take years, but camping around a city would ultimately starve it out. There would be no more food inside. Depending on the amount of provision they had stored up, they could last weeks, months, maybe years. But ultimately, your army would be victorious, for the people inside would either surrender or starve to death. Very few casualties would suffer if your army was besieging a city. Well, after a period of time, Nebuchadnezzar, whose armies were besieging Jerusalem, having surrounded it, Nebuchadnezzar showed up, wanted to see how things were going. Well, Jehoiakim and his mom and his wife and his kids and all the officers, everybody came out and said, "We surrender." And so they were carted off to Babylon. This beginning is of an exile here, of people being carted off. It says in verse 13 that he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasure of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. Then he led away into exile all Jerusalem, and all the captains, and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained except the Joneses. See, the Smiths were taken, but the Joneses were... No, none remained except the poorest people of the land. You trying to keep up with the Joneses? They're the poorest people of the land. What are you doing? So he led Jehoiakim away into exile to Babylon, also the king's mother and the king's wives and his officials and the leading men of the land. He led away into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, and all the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen and the smiths, 1,000, all strong and fit for war. And these the king of Babylon brought into exile into Babylon. Well, now that the city of Jerusalem is his, Nebuchadnezzar has looted the place of people and of objects. He took all the things of value from the king's house. He also took all the things of value from the Lord's house. The temple of the Lord was ransacked. Everything that was of value was taken. And he didn't have any desire to maintain the historical value, you might say. If we were to find a solid gold pitcher where they would carry water, or a solid silver bowl where blood would be poured into from the original temple, we would be amazed. But to him, he's like, pitchers, bowls, I don't need this stuff. Let's cut it up, melt it down, and make it into something that we want, maybe an idol or something. So many of the ancient artifacts, many of the temple treasures were destroyed. The rest were stolen. Many of them were destroyed, melted down, cut up and melted down to make other things. Everybody's been carted off from Jerusalem. Not all of Judea, but most of the people of Jerusalem. Only the poor people were left. Well, in verse 17, we see that the king of Babylon made his uncle Matanyah, king in his place, and changed his name to Tidkiyah. Tidkiyah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libnah. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For through the anger of the Lord, this came about in Jerusalem and Judah, until he cast them out from his presence. And Tzidkiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. So a new king, his uncle, Matanyah. Now, this is not, it's kind of strange in the New American Standard. I didn't think to look in any of the other translations. But it sounds kind of like the king of Babylon made his own uncle the king of Judah. That's not the case. It was actually Jehoiakim's uncle, which would have made that Josiah's son or nephew. I'm losing it. It's okay. Anyway, relative of the kings of Judah, not of the king of Babylon. Well, he was evil, doing evil, idolatrous, immoral things in the sight of the Lord. His name was changed from Matanyah to Tzidkiyah, changed by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. Have you noticed as we've gone through the scriptures up to this point and even further into the New Testament, how many people's names are changed? What's up with that? Don't they know how confusing that is? You ladies who've gotten married and changed your names, you know how confused, you know, they can't find you for the high school reunion. You know, it just makes it difficult. It's hard to do the genealogies when right in the middle of somebody's life, they go and change the names. Why do they do that? Why is it that as we've gone through the scriptures, we have seen that Joseph's name was changed by Pharaoh in Genesis 41? Why in Daniel 1 did the Babylonian commander rename the three teenagers, Daniel's friends, to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel's name was changed as well? Why in 2 Kings 23, in the 2 weeks ago when we saw that, why did Pharaoh Necho rename Eliakim? Why is it that God changed Abram's name to Abraham? Why did he change Sarai's name to Sarah? Why did Jesus change Simon's name to Peter? Are you starting to remember? Yeah, what is up with all this? Why are these names changing? What's going on? Simply this. When someone changes someone else's name, they are demonstrating that they are the authority. It's as simple as that. When someone changes your name, you're under their authority. You are in submission. You are in subjection to their authority. When the Pharaoh changed Joseph's name, he was under Joseph's authority. Joseph was under his authority. Remember, he had been in prison and then was made commander of all, commander of everything except Pharaoh. He was under Pharaoh's authority, so Pharaoh changed his name. when Abram and Sarai submitted their lives to the Lord and were under God's authority, what did God do? He changed their name to Abraham and Sarah. Now, interesting with that name, just a little divergence from my notes for a minute. If you think about that, what did God do when he changed their names? How was he under their authority? They were submitted to the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God, in Hebrew, the word spirit is ruach. It's the breath. It's a ha in Hebrew. What did Abram and Sarai's names, what happened to them specifically? God breathed into them. He put the ruach, and Abram became Abraham. Sarai became Sarah. You ever notice that? So, they were under submission to God's authority. When Simon Peter was under submission to the Lord, he renamed him from Simon to Petra, or Petros. I always get those two mixed up. He renamed him Rock. Little Rock, but Rock nonetheless. Wives, do you realize that when you take your husband's name, you are submitting to his headship as he is submitted to the headship of Christ? You know, I find it interesting that in the early and mid-70s, when the women's liberation movement was huge and women were saying, I won't submit to God's way of authority. I won't do that. I'm going to wear the pants in the family. What did they start doing? They started keeping their names. They refused to take their husband's name. That to me, it's a statement of where the heart is. It's not just that you don't like your husband's last name. There's something deeper spiritually going on. Have you submitted to the authority of Jesus Christ? In Revelation, wrong side of the Bible. In Revelation, second or the third chapter, the church of Pergamum, Jesus makes a promise. I think it's the second chapter of Revelation. He makes a promise to those in the church of Pergamum, and what he said to that church, he said to all the churches, let him who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, he said. And he said, to him who overcomes, if you've submitted yourself to the authority of Jesus Christ, and you are an overcomer in this life, to him who overcomes, I will give him a white stone and a new name written on the stone. Jesus Christ wants to give you a new name. He's already got it picked out. Nobody knows what it is. But if you're submitted to the headship of Jesus Christ, if you're under his authority, well, Matan was under Nebuchadnezzar's authority, and his name was changed to Tzidkiyah. In chapter 25, it came about that in the ninth year of his reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, he and his army against Jerusalem, camped against it, and built a siege wall around it. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. So as we saw in the last verse of chapter 24 and the result of it in the first few verses of chapter 25, King Zedekiah rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. He, like the king who had come before him, or two kings before. We're almost done with this whole kings thing. It's going to be really easy to keep track after this. Like the king who had come before him, once or twice removed, he had rebelled against the king of Babylon. The king of Babylon was content to take everything and to take all the people, but these pesky kings kept rebelling. And so he came in again and built a siege wall. And we see that the famine was so severe in the city, there was no food. There was no food at all. Now, something is very interesting in this. I don't want you to miss this. It's pretty clear at the end of the book of Chronicles, but as we're coming to the end of the book of 2 Kings, it's not as clear, and I want to point it out to you. Have you noticed that in all these months that we've been in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, we have not seen the month and year and day so specifically named? Oh, we've talked about, oh yeah, in when this king had served 20 years, then this other king came into power. But here we see some very specific days. On the 9th day of the 4th month, That's a pretty specific day, isn't it? That's a spot right on the calendar. Why is it that the dates of the siege and ultimately the exile, which we will see another date given as we continue on through this chapter, why are the dates of the siege and the exile given so specifically? Nowhere else in the book of Kings have we seen that. Why are they so important? They're important because of this. Because the prophet Jeremiah had foretold, prophesying by the Spirit of God to the people, that they would be exiled to Babylon, and that exile would last exactly 70 years. In Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 11 and 12, if you're a note taker, Jeremiah 25, 11 and 12, he said, "This whole land shall be a desolation and a horror, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then it will be, when 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, declares the Lord, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it an everlasting desolation." What was God promising? Number one, there would be a Babylonian exile. God was going to judge his people for their rebellion, for their immorality, for their idolatry. He would judge them. But he would also show grace. He would show grace. For after 70 years, he would judge those that were used to judge. He would judge them. And he would bring them, the Israelites, back into the land. Now, by giving us the exact dates, the ninth month or the fourth, what is this? The ninth day of the fourth month, by telling us this, and then later in the chapter giving us the exact date of being carted away to Babylon, the Lord enabled us to see the faithfulness that he held to his word. Daniel, a prophet after my own heart, or at least with my same name, Daniel knew this. He knew, he was just a young kid when the Babylonian captivity came. He was a teenager. But he knew what Jeremiah had spoken. He knew what Jeremiah had written. And after 60 some odd years in Babylon, and Daniel continuing to read the scriptures and reading the prophets, we see in Daniel chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, he said, "In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, observed in the books the number of the years which was revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet for the completion of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years." In other words, I was having devotions in the scriptures one morning and saw that God had said 70 years. And he said, "So I gave my attention to the Lord God to seek him by prayer and supplications with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes." Translation, I knew the time was coming up, so I started to repent. I knew the Lord was going to deliver. I wanted to be on the right side of God. I began to confess the sins of my nation as well as my personal sins, Daniel says. I prayed, I fasted, I appealed to the Lord. By telling us exactly, it was the ninth of this, it was the fourth of this, this is the day that they were carted off, we know the exact date that God started counting from 70 years to bring his people back. Daniel knew the faithfulness of God to his word. And he took God at his word. Now, you might ask, why 70 years? I mean, God seems to be partial to sevens, doesn't he? If you study the numerology of the Bible, and I don't mean numerology in an occultic sense. If you study the numerology of the Bible, you will see that it is one of God's fingerprints all through the scriptures, that numbers mean the same thing consistently throughout. Seven is no different. Seven, the number of completeness. If you speak King Jamesese, you would say the number of perfection, but the King James word for perfection literally means completeness. Not perfection as you would think of as perfect, for you know the dragon has seven heads and he is far from perfect as we see in Revelation. But it is complete. It's a complete number. Why did God choose 70 to complete the exile to Babylon. Why? What did God say? God said they were guilty of not following His law. They had violated the law of God, and He was holding them accountable to it. Now, all of us have violated the law of God, haven't we? We've all been guilty of committing sin. And unrepentant sin is judged. You want to know what kind of unrepentant sin, how long unrepentant sin went in the land of Israel, in the nation of Judah? Leviticus chapter 25, we see the Lord say, Leviticus 25, 2 through 4, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its crop. But during the seventh year, the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard." So in God's law, it was very specifically stated, saying, you can farm for 6 years. On the seventh year, let it lie fallow. You get 6 days of work a week and you get a day off. The land is mine. I've entrusted it to you. You do the same for the land. 6 years of work, 1 year of rest. We found out farming-wise, this is a very effective method for sustaining land. However, from the very day that they entered into the promised land, the land of Canaan, they never did it. They never did it. There was never a year, never one single year, where they stopped farming and let the land have its Sabbaths. For almost 500 years, they were in rebellion to the Word of God. 490 years, to be specific. How many Sabbaths was the land ripped off? 70. How literal was God going to take His word? Very literal. At the end of 2 Chronicles, the chronicler writes this for us, 36, 20, and 21. He says, "And those who had escaped from the sword, Nebuchadnezzar carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah," until what? Until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. When God says it's mine, it's mine. When God says this portion belongs to me and that portion is withheld, He'll get it one way or another. Letting that sink in each one of our lives in different areas. The Lord wants a tithe of our time. The Lord wants a tithe of our tithe. The Lord wants a portion of our lives. Actually, He wants the whole thing. But He's satisfied with us giving Him a portion. When we don't give that to Him, what happens? Well, He takes it. He warns and warns and warns and takes it. He's merciful, and He's merciful, and He's long-suffering, and He's patient. But ultimately, mercy, if mercy goes on too long, it's no longer in line with God's nature. Mercy cannot be forever, because then it wouldn't be just. And just as God is merciful, He is also just. He's a God of mercy. He's a God of justice. So how long? How many times should He forgive us? Simon Peter posed that question to Jesus, wanting to sound very spiritual, you recall, hoping to be a lot more spiritual sounding than the other 11 guys that were camping out with him. "Lord, how many times shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times?" What did the Lord say? "No, not seven times, but I say to you, 70 times seven." Was that just a fancy figure of speech? Not according to God. How many Sabbaths of the land did God forgive? How many years did God forgive? 70 times seven for 490 years. Do you ever read that way? We always think, oh, He's 490 because you just can't count that high. Some of us keep notes. Some of you have sinned against me 489 times. I've got it all right here. And praise God, our names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life, that that's not being kept as a record. 70 times 7, God forgave them in the promised land. But after 490 years, it was time to administer justice. And that 70 years that the land deserved was given back to the land. It was repaid while the Jews were in servitude in Babylon. Well, in verse 4, then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls, between the king, or beside the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were all around the city, and they went by way of the Arabah. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from him. Then they captured the king and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and he passed sentence on him. And they slaughtered the sons of Tzidkiah before his eyes, then put out the eyes of Tzidkiah and bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon. When the people were starving, when they could no longer handle it, they ran for it. They actually made it through the siege, but didn't make it. As hungry as they were, as weak as they were, the army was scattered, the army was slaughtered. The king and his family were captured, the king's sons were killed before him, that none would succeed him. And then, with that image burned into his eyes were put out. And he was put in chains and taken to Babylon. Now on the 7th day of the 5th month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, another guy named Neb, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Even every great house he burned with fire. So all the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Then the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who had deserted the king of Babylon, and the rest of the multitude, Nebuzaradan, the captain, there you go, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away into exile. But the captain of the guard left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. So this is really the poorest of the poor. Now the bronze pillars which were in the house of the Lord, and the stands, and the bronze sea which were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke in pieces and carried the bronze to Babylon. The bronze laver where the priests would wash the blood of the sacrifices off their hands and feet, symbolic of the word of God, it was broken. It was broken into pieces. The pillars that... oh, I wish I'd written down their name. I remember one was named Boaz. I can't remember the other, but Solomon had erected these pillars. They were broken up, carted away for the value of bronze. They took away the pots, the shovels, the snuffers, the spoons, all the bronze vessels which were used in temple service. The captain of the guard also took away the fire pans and the basins, what was fine gold and what was fine silver. The two pillars, the one sea and the stands which Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the bronze and all of these vessels was beyond weight. The height of the one pillar was 18 cubits, and a bronze capital was on it. And the height of the capital was 3 cubits, with a network and pomegranates on the capital all around, all of bronze. And the second pillar was like these, with network. You can picture the writer of Kings having seen these things and mourning their loss, saying, oh, you should have seen the pillars. How it was just so ornate at the top, and it was so tall and impressive. And the army of Babylon, the captain of the army of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, he just had these things broken up and carried away. And how that must have hurt him. We know, according to the prophets, we know, according to the historians, that when they came back in the days of Ezra, when they came back and they rebuilt the temple some 70-odd years later, many of the old-timers wept because it just wasn't the same. They just didn't have the money, and it wasn't the same. It was like the ornate chapel and all the stained glass and the statuary was gone, and now they were meeting in a tent and they wept. They were rebuked for weeping, for the Lord was the same. But they remembered how impressive Solomon's temple was. And you can tell that the king, or the writer of the Kings here, had seen this, and just hear the sadness in his heart as he writes this. Well, then the captain of the guard took Seraiah, the chief priest, and Zephaniah, the second priest, with the three officers of the temple. And from the city he took one official who was overseer of the men of war, and five of the king's advisors who were found in the city, and the scribe of the captain of the army who mustered the people of the land, and 60 men of the people of the land who were found in the city. And Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, took them and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. Then the king of Babylon struck them down and put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamath. So Judah was led away into exile from its land. So they took the people of prominence, the people of importance, the high priest, the priest that was directly under him, the scribes, numerous prominent citizens. They were carted away and put to death. Verse 22, now as for the people who were left in the land of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had left, he appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, over them. When all the captains of the forces, they and their men, heard the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah governor, they came to Gedaliah to Mizpah, namely Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah. We'll just skip all these. A lot of guys came to Gedaliah, the governor. And Gedaliah swore to them and their men and said to them, don't be afraid of the servants of the Chaldeans. Just live in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and it will be well with you. So this governor saying, let's just make the best of it. We're conquered. This has been by the hand of God. So let's just make the best of it and submit to the people that are our authorities now. Well, how did they take that? Well, they took that about as good as any other godly counsel. It came about in the seventh month that all these guys came with 10 men and struck Gedaliah down so that he died along with the Jews and the Chaldeans who were with him at Mizpah. Then all the people, both small and great, and the captains of the forces arose and went to Egypt, for they were afraid of the Chaldeans. So they rose up and killed the governor, Gedaliah, who was trying to make the best of this circumstance, of this situation. And they killed him. They didn't want to hear it. I found that to be true any time that you say, look, this is the predicament we're in. This is where God has us. Let's just now follow the way of God, whether you're talking about submitting or praying or whatever it is. And you very likely will have a number of people rise up against you and start hacking on you. Well, and they will wipe you out if they can. But, you know, it's fun to do anyway. So, verse 27. It came about that in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Remember Jehoiakim? He was the guy that was captured, carted away long time ago. Well, in the 37th year of his exile, he's been in prison all this time. That on the 27th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, he's now come after Nebuchadnezzar, in the year that he became king, released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison, and he spoke kindly to him and set his throne above the throne of the kings who were with him in Babylon. And Jehoiakim changed his prison clothes and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the day of his life. And for his allowance, a regular allowance was given to him by the king, a portion for each day, all the days of his life. Do you get the feeling that the writer of the book of Kings finished in verse 27, said, end of story? And somebody read it and went, what a depressing book. Can't you end it on a happy note? Okay, well, the king kind of, after 37 years in prison, he kind of had a good deal. and then it's done, and then it's over with. Well, Jehoiakim did. After 37 years in prison, the new king of Babylon, the new administration came in, probably Republican, and the other one had been Democrat or whatever. And now they liked him. Now they liked him. So he was set up. And it actually reminds me of, was it Nelson Mandela that was in prison for years and years and years and then was released from prison and actually became the leader of his nation? Well, that's amazing. The same thing seemed to happen to Jehoiakim. He'd spent all this time in prison, and now He's out of the black and white stripes. You know, he changed the prison clothes. And now he's eating in the king's presence. He got an allowance, you know. He got to use the car on Saturdays. And so we we kind of end on this happy note. Is there a happy note? Well, the happy note happens 70 years from now. There's some interesting things that happen in that 70 years, as you find out when you read the book of Daniel. But what we're going to do is, since we've got a few minutes left, is I'd like to go back to 1 Kings 1 and just read the whole thing, all of Kings, all the way through. No, actually, what I'd like to do is give you a homework assignment. And that is to read a book. It's not as long as 1 and 2 Kings. Because what I'd like to do for the next month or so is take a look from a different perspective at this same time period that we see in 1 and 2 Kings. You recall a number of studies ago I mentioned that Isaiah and some of the other guys, the prophets, were prophesying during this time, and they had a much more godly perspective than these kings did. So what I'd like to do is just grab one or two of the prophets, the minor prophets. Don't worry, we're not going into Isaiah yet. I'm waiting for that one. Just grab a couple of the minor prophets and go through that and get their perspective and to see what God was saying to the people. Some people say, man, 70 years in exile, God's being pretty harsh. Well, I want you to see the minister's side of this, what God was preaching through his prophets and how the people were obstinate. So if we could bow our hearts in prayer.